Prepare yourselves for non-stop animated action featuring the world's most powerful heroes and their most fearsome foes. The Marvel Comics video library has arrived.
And welcome to Dave's Marvel Universe. I am your host, J. David Weider, and by the power invested in me by the Michigan Board of Trust, I invite you to call me Dave. And this show has a simple premise. Each episode, I read and discuss a single comic book published by Marvel in the 1980s. This time around, it's a bit of a homecoming for me as I revisit a comic that I covered elsewhere, back in the day. Specifically, many years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, or more, on Pad Smash and Incredible Hulk podcast. You would think I would have researched that, but yet I didn't. I really like keeping this spontaneity in my recording sessions. For those that have no idea what I'm talking about, Pad Smash and Incredible Hulk podcast was a show that I produced in 2011 going forward for a few years. I co-hosted it with Lee Busby and Michael Bailey, and we covered the run of writer Peter David on the title Incredible Hulk. Now, Peter David's run ran from issue 331 to issue 467, similar to the Mark Gruenwald run that I talked about. Pretty chunky. And it took the Hulk on a huge journey by the time it was done. Hulk turned gray, he became a bouncer in Vegas for a while, then he turned green and smart, and much more. It's a heck of a run, all things considered. For a while, David was joined by artist Todd McFarlane, who was following up a run on DC's Infinity Inc., and would famously, and very quickly, go on to a run in Amazing Spider-Man, which would redefine Spider-Man and art, and the way it's perceived. McFarlane would actually flip the script because he'd become one of the first marquee names as far as comic book artists go, and then many, many more would follow. So what changed was how comics were marketed and how they were bought, in all honesty. To our issue, at this point in McFarlane's career, he was not a huge name. He hadn't exploded the way he would in the next, really the next year is when it's really going to happen for him. As in a year from this particular issue we're talking about. In our issue, we pick up with the Gray Hulk, who is cranky and notably more talkative than you would think. He's not just content to say Hulk smash, leave Hulk alone, Hulk is strongest there is. He's in complete sentences and he has a lot of opinions. This is a result of, frankly, a very long story. To break it down very simply, Banner and Hulk were split for a while, it didn't go well, when they re-merged it went awry, and thus we get a new version of the Hulk. That's kind of more like the original version from The Incredible Hulk number 1. We find him partnering with his old friend Rick Jones and rogue S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Clay Quartermain as they're searching for gamma bombs stashed by the government. Now that's not going to come into play very heavily in the issue we're looking at. We also have Wolverine showing up. Wolverine famously made his first appearance within the books Incredible Hulk 180 and 181. There, Hulk and Wolverine threw down for the very first time, but not the last. At this point, I think Wolverine is tied with the Thing as far as fighting the Hulk over and over again, just kind of becoming a thing. No pun intended. Where we're finding Wolverine this time is that he is the leader of the X-Men. He's been developed as a bit of a failed samurai in the Chris Claremont and Frank Miller miniseries. And he's gone forward trying to quell the raging beast that lies within him. And he's done a pretty good job at this point. We also find that we are right on the fringes of the X-Men segment of Fall of the Mutants, which was a trilogy of stories, really. In this case, we're dealing with a villain called the Adversary, which is causing distortions in reality that I need to call out here. That's important for context because the scene is midsummer in Dallas, Texas, and suddenly you have a huge blizzard. And that's where we lay our scene, and if anybody has ever been to Texas, you know snow is very scarce, especially in the Dallas area. Much less in the middle of summer, so I wanted to make sure we lay that scene there. But that should be all the setup we need. After a podcast promo break, we are going to look at a throwdown between the Incredible Hulk and the Savage Wolverine in Incredible Hulk number 340. I'll be right back with you.
When you think of podcasts about religion, you probably think of this.
But at least one religion podcast sounds more like this.
I kick ass for the Lord!
Dorkness to Light is a relatively geeky production in which Alan and Emily discuss topics of faith, religion, and spirituality.
But we do so through the lens of pop culture, like movies, TV, and comic books, because we're nerds.
Our primary focus will be on Christianity, because that's what we know best. But all religious content is on the table.
Well, think about it, Scully, from vampirism to Catholicism.
This is an occasional cast, to be recorded and released as the mood strikes, with topics ranging from in-depth reviews to personal rants about some small aspect of theology or church history, because we're theological nerds.
If these topics interest you, check out dorknesstolight.blogspot.com for our more regular content.
Or dorknesstolight.tumblr.com for our more irregular content. Memes and puns, mostly. My bad.
Dorkness to Light.
Often irreverent, rarely sacrilegious.
Doc Bruce Banner, belted by gamma rays, turned into the Hulk.
Ain't he on glamour rays?
Wrecking the town with the power of a bull.
Ain't no monster clown who is as lovable
as ever-loving Hulk.
Welcome back. Incredible Hulk number 340 came to us with a February 1988 cover date. Our cover is by Todd McFarlane, of course, and it shows Wolverine snarling at the reader with his adamantium claws bared, and reflected in the indestructible metal is the gray face of the Hulk, also equally angry. I did not intend to talk about two comics in a row that have covers that are genuinely qualifying for the term iconic, sort of the covers you think of first for that particular character. It was just luck of the draw. But I gotta admit, the energy in this cover is intense, and it really sells the idea of a hardcore fight between Wolverine and the Hulk. It's just a bit gnarly in the scratchy details. That's sort of just McFarlane's trademark, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we look at the interior art. But you want it ruined? I'll ruin it for you. Look at Wolverine's claws very closely, and you'll begin to realize that their position does not make sense. They're turned awkwardly in the socket, and not evenly. Which I get is a sacrifice for a really good composition, which is fine at a glance, but if you really think about this, it'll start to bug you more and more. The title of our tale is Vicious Circle, and no, you heard that right, not Cycle, Circle, though both will come into play. It was written by Peter A. David, aka Pad, with art by Todd McFarlane, letters by Rick L. Parker, no relation to Peter, and colors were done by Petra Goldberg. Looking at the synopsis, Rick Jones, the Hulk, and Clay Quartermain are driving through a winter storm in Dallas, when the Hulk decides that he needs to get out for some air. Since you don't really say no to the big cranky gray guy, Hulk is set free to go leaping through the sky where he narrowly misses the X-Men's Blackbird jet. But in his overcorrection, Hulk accidentally smacks into the engine of a passenger plane and sets it ablaze. The X-Men's rogue tosses the fiery engine off the plane and helps the plane land. Unfortunately, the engine lands on the Hulk down on the ground and royally ticks the gray Goliath off even more. Later, the Hulk is cornered by the police when he busts into a food truck to get some grub, and that's when Wolverine shows up, having caught the Hulk scent on the plane earlier. Wolverine initially doesn't want to fight, he's not that guy anymore, but the Hulk goads and attacks him until the two throw down. The fight is finally broken up by Clay Quartermain, and Wolverine has a somber realization that he hasn't made as much progress from his old self as he originally thought. As Hulk lifts the van with Clay and Rick inside of it and leaps off, Wolverine is left thinking that he can't remember the last time that he wanted a cigar this badly. And that's a curtain drop on Incredible Hulk number 340. One thing I'll mention up front here is that there is a bit of a subplot of sorts, with Betty Ross in a hotel room. She's looking at a snow globe, which is how we transition in and out of that, which is nice. And she's pondering her relationship with Bruce Banner. I don't really want to get into that just yet, but I will be coming back to it towards the latter part of my notes. I just wanted to call it out because that's the first thing you see as you open the book, and frankly the last thing. So we'll come back to it, but jumping into the story more properly, the winter weather is blotting out the moonlight, and that makes the Hulk a little bit crankier and a little bit stronger. Because they figured out that Hulk comes out at night for one thing, which reflects exactly how it happened in the original Incredible Hulk series. At least on the onset, there were several different modes where the Hulk turned from Banner to Hulk. At one point, it was just Banner going onto a machine and bringing out the Hulk intentionally. Think about that. But initially, he was a nighttime creature. And Peter David brought that back, and you see his strength and mood kind of ebb and flow with the lunar cycles. So at this point, it's set up that Hulk is very angry and very riled up just because of the lunar cycle, and the fact that that's thrown off by the winter itself, which is unnatural. Which is a nice way of setting up why the Hulk is going to egg Logan on down the road, because he really needs to scrap. It's something where he has to vent. Mark Waid would use something like this where Bruce takes Tony Stark in his Iron Man gear out in the middle of nowhere so they can start a fight to kind of let the Hulk ease off some of his steam. Now, that's a much more in control Banner, somebody who's accepted his particular condition and knows how to let it kind of alleviate itself to some extent. That is definitely not the case here. Hulk just happens to be cranky to begin with, then he gets an engine dropped on him, he gets shot at when he gets food, and when Wolverine shows up and stabs him, oh, it's on like Donkey Kong. You know, looking at McFarlane's version of the Hulk, he's very, at least facially speaking, he's very Cro-Magnon, and there's a lot of lines there, making him look really gnarly. Kind of grizzled. And to me, that's a bit of a reflection of the horror icons of the 1980s versus something like Karloff's Frankenstein, which was one of the inspirations for the Hulk. So we're kind of leaning into the more Jason Voorhees, Freddy Krueger style of monster, and it fits. And the artist that follows McFarlane, Jeff Purvis, kind of takes this as well. So with the Hulk coming from a horror vibe, being inspired by Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Frankenstein, it fits that should be updated to the times. I don't know that the 70s really got that because it leaned back into more superhero type activity. But Peter David was really, really good in his run at referencing the old school material. I mean, just turning the Hulk gray is a bit of a deep cut because he was gray for exactly one issue. And that was the first issue before he got changed to green because the printing presses of the time didn't really take to gray. But for some reason, to me, this issue, the horror elements of the Hulk really stood out. In a good way. Now, let's look at the X-Men lineup as they enter the picture. We have Wolverine, who's our main POV character. He's the guy we're here to see, the ultimate guest star. But we also have Rogue, who has settled well into the X-Men at this point. And then we get Longshot. Because of course we get Longshot. Why wouldn't we get Longshot? Rogue, you're probably familiar with. She's been in multiple iterations of the franchise, in the big screen, in animation, so on and so forth. But of course, she can touch people and absorb their powers if they're a mutant or something other than that. And she once absorbed Carol Danvers' strength and flight. That's right, Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers. Rogue is almost as powerful as she is, at least in two categories. Longshot, however, is just lucky. I mean, that's really his power. He defies probability and so on, so he's actually extremely lucky. And then I don't know, I'm not a big Longshot fan, so I'm not going to go too far down that road. We also have Dazzler, who thankfully is out of her disco phase, and she can shoot light, basically turning sound into light. We have Havoc, who, you know, I've never really understood his power completely. It's plasma bursts. Basically, it's stuff that'll wreck you. And we have the original flavor Psylocke, that is British. Now, I'm a fan of Psylocke when she becomes Quanon, because you get these powers, British attitude, and ninjutsu, and I'm down for that. And looking at where they are costume-wise, I realize Rogue really, really struggled with costumes until Jim Lee gave her a more definitive costume, the animated series costume. Because she has this very plain Jazzercise look, and Dazzler does too, but Dazzler's is a trade-up, because Dazzler came from the disco era. She was based on Donna Summer. I know you wouldn't guess that by looking at her for various reasons, but the inspiration was to tie into a movie in which Donna Summer would be the star. Things didn't go exactly as planned, so we get Dazzler as we know her now. I don't know how to describe Psylocke's costume other than, man, we get a trade-up down the road. And then there's Longshot, who looks like a Dollar General militant Billy Idol impersonator. With a mullet. Maybe it's the mullet that has me prejudiced against Longshot. I don't know, but Wolverine is in his tan and brown suit, or what I call the Secret Wars look, the General Wolverine look, and this is my look. I love this so much. It's sleek, it feels animal-like, and it isn't, you know, day glow yellow. Having said that, I've never understood why Logan's hair sweeps back the way it does, unless it's just the way the mask fits on him. And the way McFarlane draws Logan here without the mask, he is blatantly Clint Eastwood, which is fine with me, especially a Eastwood of this particular vintage. That's totally okay with me. And you know, I looked at this book for the longest time. I looked at Havoc, whose costume is this simple black suit with these disc designs on the chest and this sort of high school metal shop art project on top of his head. I don't know art, but I know what I like. I had always assumed that the black section of Havoc's face was not a mask, but shadows of a headpiece. But the more I look at it, the more I Googled, it's like he has the masked cowl over his head with that art piece on it. I know that's not the most important thing, it's not very relevant, but since I spent so long staring at it and Googling it, I felt like it should be in the recording somewhere. I also feel really, really confident just saying that between Wolverine's peaked edges and Rogue's over-the-top, spiked look, Vidal Sassoon survived the decade solely due to Xavier's beauty product budget. This hair is off the charts ridiculous, and you know these two are primping. Before each mission, they're in there with their brushes and their... Oh, I don't even want to go down this road. But yeah, I'm pretty certain that, thankfully, Rogue and Wolverine saved Vidal Sassoon and got them through the 80s. Maybe the 90s, too. Now that I think about it, I'm pretty certain the 90s benefited because Rogue had huge, big Texas hair. So as mentioned in the synopsis, the Hulk has to correct and he bounces off a plane's engine, knocking the engine down. It's like a pinball, except the pinball machine breaks. It kind of hit me hard, no pun intended, that this is the scale that the Hulk lives on. He's just bigger than the rest of us, both in size and just sort of the way he exercises, the way he does simple things. I mean, if I'm running through the house and I have to course correct, I bounce off the couch. No harm done. I don't bring down planes, and hopefully you don't either. But that's the scale he lives on, and then we move into... it's an interesting bit, I don't know if it's good or bad, but we see Wolverine delegating responsibility. He sends Rogue to save the plane, which ends up causing the engine to drop on the Hulk, and later he's scrambling the team to save bystanders. I feel a little weird pointing this out, but it's a very Cyclops sequence of events. It's very, very much Scott Summers' words coming out of Wolverine's mouth, and it's a little weird. I mean, I guess from this vantage point, it's good to see Wolverine has developed and kind of understood why Cyclops makes some of the decisions he made. But at the same time, it's hard to stomach the idea that this guy who has pushed Cyclops back and just rebelled against every order the guy ever made is suddenly becoming more and more like that guy, without actually admitting, okay, maybe I misjudged Cyclops. But just when you think Wolverine's really making progress, he ends up calling the Hulk a jerk, and the Hulk actually gets the drop on Wolverine. Of course, this is a Hulk that is sneakier and stealthier. He's smarter in a lot of ways. Maybe I would actually call it crafty, because Professor Hulk is smarter down the road. He's a literal rocket scientist. This guy is just crafty. He knows how to fight dirty. But the Hulk would have absolutely smashed Wolverine if he hadn't growled at the split second before he hit the guy. And Wolverine's face is priceless as Hulk is bounding at him. You just have this sort of, oops, look. It's fantastic. And we don't see the claws in the shot. We just have the snicked sound, which is like a knee-jerk reaction. Uh-oh, snicked. I guess that goes together. And the scene doesn't go the way you think it will, because Wolverine does some stabbing and realizes what's going on, and he tells the Hulk, I'm sorry, my mistake, which is fantastic. That is the energy the world needs right now. You make a big boo-boo, you admit to it, and move on. Wolverine does not need this fight. He doesn't want this fight. He has work that he needs to be doing, and he's doing everything he can just to move forward. So Wolverine is realizing that this is basically like arguing on the internet. You don't get much out of it, you've got other things you should be doing, and you're going to be worse off for having engaged. However, the Hulk is not as enlightened, and he jumps Wolverine again. And the thing is about Hulk, it makes me realize that Hulk, it always has to be, leave me alone, and nobody will. That's the cycle that the Hulk exists in. The Hulk can be out minding his own business, and somebody will come along, mess with him, and get him provoked again. That's kind of actually the template. That Hulk will find a spot of goodness in his life, a spot of peace, and something will come along and damage it. It has to. It's just the fact that this is comics, and Hulk is one of the trickier characters. Because if Hulk remains in a good place for too long, suddenly it becomes stagnant. I mean, you literally will run out of stories if Hulk's in a good place, just being a good guy. It's not in the template. It's not why we read Hulk. He's a tragic character. Peter David even acknowledges this. Down the road, the Hulk becomes a merged personality. You have Banner's intelligence, the Green Hulk's raw strength, and the Gray Hulk's attitude and craftiness. The best of all three worlds, and it makes a very compelling read, but eventually that's going to run out of steam, and it does. And Peter David pivots once again. The reason I bring that up here is that the Hulk was essentially minding his own business, leaping around, he gets hit by a plane, gets an engine dropped on him, he's trying to eat, he gets shot at, and then Wolverine shows up, and it's the bridge too far. At this point, something in the Hulk is conditioned to fight when this stuff comes along. Only this time around, the Hulk is a little bit more proactive. He sees it coming, so he just decides to run with it. Fine. You want me? Here I am. It doesn't matter at this point that Wolverine is trying to walk away and move on. At this point, Wolvie's already called down the thunder. And to Hulk's mind, this is inevitable. Somebody's going to come along and fight. He's already cranky. He's already been disturbed. Fine. Let's beat the little dude up. And the Hulk almost stomps on Wolverine. Wolverine dodges it, you could see it, and then you see Wolverine bouncing around off the Hulk, which is a nice visual clue on how differently these two fight, how they can kind of meet in the middle. Despite their entire strengths, their entire attributes being completely different ends of the spectrum. And that's when the issue turns dark as Wolverine loses it. I don't know if it's full berserker rage, but it's hardcore enough that he is convinced that he's killed the Hulk, and he's happy about it. He's reveling in the fact that he just stabbed the dude so many times, and the Hulk is laying there in a heap of his own blood. That's right. Wolverine, who was trying to be civilized, trying to convince himself that he's a good leader, that he's a good man, that he's past all this, loses it. And for just a moment, he's glad. He feels it. He feels that adrenaline rush. And here, the Hulk's blood, and there's a lot of it, his blood is depicted as green, which brings up a lot of questions. Does Banner bleed green? How does the blood change when the transformation goes from Banner to Hulk? How does any of that work? And here, I'm going to give you the most enlightened answer I know how to give. The real answer is there's no way that the Comics Code Authority, which was active at this time, would allow red blood. That was a well-known no-no in the Comics Code. So when we see the buckets of blood here, if that was red, this book would not have made it to the stand. So it's just an excuse to have the Hulk bleed. Now here's where we find out that the Hulk actually has a healing factor that moves so fast everybody assumes that he's just completely indestructible. So he's not completely invulnerable, and that allows for just enough room to put some weakness on the table. It's something his enemies can exploit. But it also means that the Hulk is now standing up and says, let's try that again. And from here, admittedly, the issue descends into a full-on beat-em-up. It's a fight. And it's the kind of thing that you would do with your toys, assuming that your toys didn't break by slamming them together. Also, unfortunately, the Hulk did not get a Secret Wars figure from Mattel. So I guess you'd have to speed ahead to like the Toy Biz, Marvel Superheroes, and first wave of X-Men from Toy Biz for those figures, which they are really breakable. Believe me, I've broken more than my fair share. But it's definitely the kind of beatdown you imagine as a kid. It's full-on frenzy, and it's a blast. Now, in the book, we also have the two best panels lined up right against the worst panels of the book. The best panels in the issue echo the cover. You have a close-up of Wolverine's eye and a close-up of the Hulk's eye, and their enemies are reflected there. The worst is right below it, where you have the two enemies running at each other, and it's like some of the detail gets dropped out. I don't know if this is because I'm reading it on Comixology, and the recoloring process has washed out some of that, or if this is just where some of the cuts had to be made so that the book could come in on time. But the real standout here is the wonky way that Wolverine's arm is in the panel. It's a small panel, it doesn't look natural, and it bothers me. But these two would have really gone at each other longer, but Clay Quartermain blasts them with a gun and splits them up and says, don't you have something better to do? Which Wolverine says, yeah, I do. The thing is, Wolverine accepts that he got caught. You can see it in the image. He's just sort of droopy, but Hulk is kind of like the older brother about to hug it out, just to show that, oh, this is sibling love. We're good. We're not fighting, mother. I have no idea if it's intentional, but I can't see anything other than that. It's hilarious. Here's where I want to point something out. The Hulk comes off as the villain in this issue. He doesn't come off looking good. Because admittedly, he had some provocation, but he still goaded Wolverine into a fight. And in the end, the Hulk's completely unrepentant. Doesn't matter how much property damage he did. It doesn't matter that he could have signaled himself to the US government, which is on the tail of Quartermain and crew. For him, it's all about telling Wolverine that he's the best. Which is an element of the Green Hulk. It shows an ego in this version of the Hulk that we haven't seen before. Because at least when the Green Hulk, when he would boast about his strength, you kind of understood that this was something that was simpler. A creature that didn't really process things the same way that you and I would, at least not as an adult. When the Gray Hulk says it, Hulk is like the guy in the bar fight, who was losing right up to the point where the fight got broken up. So with his wounded ego, and maybe this is something the Hulk carries with him, but his wounded ego has him boast. It just doesn't come off well for the Hulk, but at the same time, it's not supposed to. Wolverine, on the other hand, Wolverine realizes that for all of his talk about personal progress, how civilized he is, how much he has worked on himself, he's still susceptible to becoming violent. More so, he's susceptible to enjoying it, which is a stark reality for him, that not only did he fall, it wasn't accidental, he indulged it, he enjoyed it. That's powerful because it immediately brings to mind stories of addiction, where you have this person who was proudly clean for so long, living a good life, getting it together, and then they have a relapse and destroy all of it. That's why they look at themselves always as a recovering addict or recovering alcoholic, because one little misstep and you're going back down the same path again, the path of destruction. And that's where you get the circle. Doesn't matter how much progress you've made, you can still find yourself back at square one very easily. That kind of brings us back to the Betty subplot. Betty and Bruce, another aspect of the rinse, lather, repeat aspect of the Hulk that I mentioned. There's always going to be something where these two come back together. And the imagery here is the snow globe shatters, and it's a model of the ship they got married on. And the image of a ship kind of brings up that idea of ships passing in the night, or, you know, ships crashing into each other. It's basically saying that whatever currents life has for them, it will always bring them back, good or bad. And I think overall the theme of cycles and circles, I think that's a powerful theme given the nature of ongoing periodical story models. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized no matter what iteration of a character you're looking at, there's always an iconic version of that character that you'll have to go back to, a root version if you will. The Hulk is a perfect example. The iconic version has Hulk being Bruce Banner, who gets angry or upset and turns green, wears shredded purple pants, and then tells everybody to leave him alone, talks in third person, and smashes stuff. It doesn't matter that we have a Hulk here who's gray, who speaks in full sentences, who teams up with people, reluctantly, but he does it, to find gamma bombs. Eventually, that character is going to revert back to the iconic version, if only for a little while. Comic book relationships are the same way. It doesn't matter how long Spider-Man was dating the Black Cat, he still ended up with Mary Jane Watson because that is the template. Likewise, Bruce Banner and Betty Ross keep coming back together. Now there's variations on the theme, but it happens again and again and again. And you have Wolverine. No matter how much time is invested in developing him and changing him and reinventing him and having his clone take over as Wolverine, you're always going to come back to this crazy little Canadian berserker. Because that's his core failure, his core weakness. It's his defining characteristic. At the same time, this issue is a commentary on real-world issues like addiction, like anger management, like relationships, toxic or unhealthy as they can be. And at the same time, it's acting as a meta-commentary on comic book storytelling. It's all of these things because life is cycles, life is circles. As much as I want to be committed to a good diet, eating well, and exercising regularly, it's easy to fall off that wagon and find yourself back at square one where you have to begin to build your endurance, to learn to eat in moderation, all over again. And with this issue, it's like giving a dog medicine. Peter David wraps the point in meat and gives us the good stuff nestled in a knockdown, drag-out fight between the Hulk and Wolverine. Now, I don't know if Wolverine's appearance was by editorial mandate. It's very possible that it was. Put Wolverine on the cover, you'll sell more issues. Regardless, Peter David does something relevant with Wolverine, and Logan comes out of it, if not changed, at least realizing how much he hasn't changed and how much he needs to work on himself. And sadly, the Hulk's true colors are revealed, and they're not pretty. But let's be honest, it's the Hulk. Is he man or monster that was on the very first issue? Here, he's more monster. That's not a bad thing, because the Hulk belongs to so many genres. Horror, sci-fi, superhero, or any merging of these particular genres. So it's fine, you can tell this kind of story with the Hulk where he doesn't come off looking all that great. Todd McFarlane was given some very powerful toys to play with, and it comes off feeling a lot like a standard Todd McFarlane comic. Except it's not quite as self-indulgent as McFarlane would become. There's no splash pages to sell on the black market. So it ends up being a fun romp without being obnoxious. I know Peter David and Todd McFarlane didn't always jive, they didn't get along, and it would show in some of the issues, some of these early Incredible Hulk issues together. They didn't quite go together, but at least here, they're in simpatico. So they're telling the same story, they're on the same page, and that really works. So as is the custom here, I'm going to put my brain algorithms into the Weeder meter. This is a machine that measures my reaction in synapses in 156 categories to give a solid scientific rating, with 5 being the best, 0 being the worst. So let's see what we've got here. It looks like the Weeder meter gives the Incredible Hulk number 340 a 3.25 out of 5. A very above average issue, but not life-changing. Not a huge event, but a very top-notch read. It's interesting to me, looking at this, that Fall of the Mutants would see the X-Men die when facing the adversary, only to have them relocated in Australia, with the world thinking them dead. Likewise, this Gamma Bomb plot leads to the Hulk's assumed death, once again publicly believed dead, only to find him show up in Las Vegas and assuming the role of casino bouncer Mr. Fix-It. I assume this is unintentional that these themes intermix for a moment in an issue that was somewhat serving as a one-off breather issue rather than major entries into the canon. But it's a nice bit of synchronicity. Now, Todd McFarlane would make his debut in Amazing Spider-Man very soon after this issue. In fact, this issue came out on October 28th. Amazing Spider-Man number 298 came out on November 10th, leaving a very short window here and a little bit of overlap with Todd McFarlane's runs. Todd McFarlane would leave with The Incredible Hulk with issue number 345, and Jeff Purvis would have a solid run after that. Sadly, Peter David and Todd McFarlane would have a long-standing feud with each other. Fortunately, the Peter David run hit stride after Todd McFarlane left. However, I'll be honest, it was not because Todd McFarlane left. That was just timing where the story really kicked in, with the Joe Fix-It era beginning. This would gel into something awesome overall, something very out of the box and fun. while at the same time being very character-focused. I'm a big fan of this run, and I did a podcast previously to it, so what does it feel like to revisit something you covered before? Well, it feels like reuniting with an old friend. Some of the excitement and discovery may be gone as far as the early parts of your friendship, but it's good to know it's out there. And having not listened to that episode where I covered this previously, I assume I found some new nuances, at least I hope I did, and didn't just repeat everything I said. I mean, it's been almost 10 years. I could have repeated everything verbatim for all I know. But that brings us to the end of another episode of Dave's Marvel Universe. Next time, it's time for some Spider-Man, and our first outing with the Wall Crawler packs a huge punch. Amazing Spider-Man 248 is next time. Bring tissues, everybody. Until then, please remember that Lisa Frank did those glorious art pieces on Trapper Keepers. Do not confuse her with Anne Frank or things will get awkward really fast. Until next time, I'm J. David Weider. Thanks for stopping by my universe. This show is made for entertainment purposes only and does not draw revenue from the material discussed. All opinions are those of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other individual, entity, or organization. Music is provided by Danya Valdovas. It is used based on a royalty-free agreement. For links to the artist's other works, please visit davesmarveluniverse.com. All other music or sound clips are believed used under fair use and are used for entertainment and illustrative purposes only. Copyrights lie with the copyright holders and no infringement is intended. If you're into the social medias, the show does have a Facebook page. Just search out Dave's Marvel Universe on Facebook. Or you can find me on Twitter, at Dave Weider. Weider is spelled W-E-T-E-R. Show notes, links to other podcatcher feeds, and much more are available at davesmarveluniverse.com, the home base for the show.